Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live every weekday from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time and whatever time that is for you. We're on stations across the country, so obviously it's different times when it's live. And some stations run the program at a delayed time later in the day, so you might not be listening to a live program. That's why I want you to know if it's between 2 and 3 in the afternoon Pacific time, that's when the program is live, and that's right now. If you would like to call in with questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or you want to talk about something upon which you and the host do not agree, feel free to give me a call at this number. It's 844-484-5737. Now, it looks like we have a couple of lines open still. The number is 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Abraham from Port Orange, Florida. Abraham, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, Steve. My question today is in regards to eschatology, and I know you get a lot of questions on that, but you're so knowledgeable, I figured I'd ask one that I haven't heard you address. Can you explain to me what the difference is between premillennialism and dispensationalism? And then can you give me some examples of how you would speak to a premillennial Christian, just sort of what biblical arguments you would have, because I have a friend who is premillennial, but I thought premillennialism and dispensationalism were the same thing, and he has said, no, they're not.
All right.
So could you address that?
Well, he's correct. I'm going to put you on hold, or you can hang up. There's some traffic noise behind you, so I'm going to make it quiet.
Okay, no problem. I'll hang up and listen to you on the air.
Okay, great. Premillennialism is simply the belief that there will be a millennium established, a thousand-year reign of peace established by Christ when he returns. Now, dispensationalists believe that, and therefore they are premillennialists. But dispensationalists have a lot of particular views which are not necessarily part of premillennialism. In other words, dispensationalists are one branch of premillennialism. They, as well as all premillennialists, believe that when Jesus comes back, he will set up a kingdom on earth for a thousand years. Now, the dispensationalists believe this will be a kingdom governed by a Jewish temple and a Jewish temple order, a Jewish priests and animal sacrifices. They also believe that before Jesus comes back, there'll be a pre-tribulational rapture. That is a rapture of the church, the removal of the church 7 years before Jesus actually returns. And they believe that there's a very important role that Israel plays in the whole end time scenario. So these are specific dispensational additives to premillennialism. Now, premillennialism was around in the early church, and many of the church fathers were premillennial. Not all of them were, but many were. Well, let me put it this way. We don't have writings from very many church fathers in the earliest centuries. The ones we have seem to be premillennial, and yet they mention that there were many Christians who were not premillennial. I don't think we have any writings from any amillennial Christians prior to Origen, and that would be in the 3rd century. But we have, of course, very limited writings from that period, that early period anyway. So there was premillennialism in the church in the first 3 centuries, and we call what they believed historic premillennialism. And historic premillennialism is a term that's used to distinguish it from dispensational premillennialism. Your friend who doesn't want to be called a premillennialist, but who, I mean, he does want to be called a premillennialist, but he doesn't want to be called a dispensationalist. He believes in a future millennium, but he probably does not believe in a rapture prior to the tribulation. That is, he's not pre-trib. That would be a dispensationalist position. He may not believe that Israel plays a significant role in the end times. That's particularly a dispensationalist position. And he probably does not believe that there's a Jewish temple, Jewish priests, and Jewish animal sacrifices in the millennium. That also is a dispensational position. In many respects, the historic premillennialists held most of the same views that amillennialists hold, with the exception of their view about the millennium. Amillennialists and historic premillennialists all believe that the rapture occurs at the end of the age when Jesus comes back, not 7 years earlier, not any bit earlier, just on the last day. And they don't believe that Israel has special status with God. The early Christians didn't, whether they were premillennial or amillennial. They didn't believe that the nation of Israel had any special status in the end times. And they certainly didn't believe, neither of you would believe, that there'd be any use for the temple and its sacrifices again in the future, like the dispensationalists believe. So you've got really two branches of premillennialism. Both of them are premillennial in that they believe Jesus' coming is before the millennium. That's why it's called premillennial. They believe in the premillennial coming of Christ, that he comes and then the millennium is set up for 1,000 years. And yet the historic premillennialists don't have the distinctives of the dispensational view, especially differing in the pre-tribulational rapture, in the importance of Israel in the end times, and in the idea of a Jewish centered millennial worship at the a rebuilt temple with Jewish priests and animal sacrifices and so forth. So those distinctives belong to dispensationalism, and most of the premillennialists that you meet are dispensationalists. But you do meet people who say, no, I don't go for that stuff, but I do hold the view of the early church fathers, which is historic premillennialism. That would be probably your friend's position. All right, let's talk to Pat from Portland, Oregon. Pat, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Steve. I'm glad I got a hold of you. I have a question that's kind of a Bible stumper for me, and it's two scriptures, one from the Old and one from the New. In Ephesians 4:8, where it says Jesus led captivity captive, and then it says he gave gifts to men. And my Bible refers back to Psalm 68:18. And when I look that up, it says he led captivity captive and he received gifts from men.
Yeah.
So I'm having a hard time understanding, is Ephesians supposedly quoting Psalm 68, or what am I missing?
Yes, Paul is quoting Psalm 68, but he's apparently quoting it from the Septuagint. The Septuagint was a Greek translation of the Old Testament, and when the Jewish scholars translated the Hebrew text into Greek, they gave us what's called the Septuagint. Now, at many points, the Septuagint and our Hebrew text are not quite the same. This is one of those instances. Did the psalm originally say that he gave gifts to men or that he received gifts from men? The psalm as we have it now, which is translated in our Bibles from the Hebrew text, it says he received gifts from men. Paul, quoting, I believe, from the Septuagint in this case, said he gave gifts to men. So the direction the gifts were going differs, apparently, right, in the two renderings. Now, it's not entirely clear whether the Septuagint is more reliable than the Hebrew text. Our instincts may tell us initially that the Hebrew text is better because the Bible is written in the Old Testament was written in Hebrew and later translated into Greek. So where the Hebrew text and the Greek text differ in the Old Testament, we might say, well, we should go with the Hebrew text and the Greek is a bad translation. But there's another way of looking at it, and that is that the Septuagint was translated from Hebrew texts that are much older than the Hebrew texts we now have available. For example, the oldest Hebrew texts of the Old Testament we have are from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, those were written maybe 300 years later than the translation of the Septuagint, which must have used earlier Hebrew manuscripts that we don't have. Now, the question is, how old were the ones that they were using? They might have been using manuscripts that were 500 years older than the Dead Sea Scrolls, for all we know. But the thing is, it's not impossible to speculate that the Hebrew text changed through copying a little bit here and there. It does a little bit over the years. And that the Septuagint preserves the true reading of a more ancient Hebrew text than what we have available. Our Bibles, of course, can only use the Hebrew texts that are available to us, but they may be more recent than they were certainly more recent than the ones that that the Septuagint translators use. So it's possible that the reading in the Septuagint is to be preferred. Paul, and well, the New Testament writers quoted from the Septuagint extensively. The writer of the Hebrews, who quoted lots of scriptures in his book, only used the Septuagint. And Paul and even Jesus and Peter and so forth also used the Septuagint, though not with 100% consistency. So it's a textual variant, and we might say, well, since we have the difference, we don't know which is right. But since Paul quoted the one he did, I think I'd go with the reading that Paul had.
Awesome. That makes sense. Okay, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much. We do try to make sense here if we can. Let's talk to Mark from Schenectady, New York. Well, good to hear from you, Mark. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thanks for having me, Steve. I'm asking a question from the book of Job, chapter 4, verse 17, mm-hmm. where Eliphaz says that he saw an image when he was dreaming. And it said that, "Shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall man be more pure than his maker?" What is the point of what he's trying to get across here?
Well, first of all, we don't have any reason to believe that the spirit that Eliphaz saw was a godly spirit. I mean, it could well have been an evil spirit, and therefore it's difficult to know whether it's to be trusted in what it says. But his reason for mentioning it is that he and Job's other friends were trying to make the case that God is good and man is not good, and therefore Job should recognize that if God has treated him so harshly, God can't be at fault. It must be Job that's at fault. Can a man be more righteous than his maker? The idea being that they saw the providence of God in everything that happens to Job, and they saw, therefore, that all these bad things that happen must be God's way of punishing him. Now, if God punished him when he was righteous, that would make God unrighteous. And yet Job claimed that he was righteous. Job claimed that he hadn't really done anything to deserve this. Now, to Job's friends, this translated in their minds to saying, then God has been unjust, because you're saying you're innocent, and yet God is punishing you. And for that reason, you must be saying that God is an unjust judge, and that you're more righteous than he is. And so he said, this spirit that came to me in the night said to me, can a man be more just than his maker? Which was not, the spirit was not talking about Job. Well, I guess it could be. It could be that it happened during the 7 days that his friends were sitting silently waiting to speak with Job after his disasters. I suppose the spirit could have come to Eliphaz in a night, one of those nights, and been referring to Job's case. But there's no need to assume it. I think Eliphaz is saying, I know that when bad things happen to people, it's because they're bad people. Because, otherwise God is unjust, and I remember, one of the things I know about God, and I got it from a spirit that came to me in the night, is that, you know, God is good and man is not good. So, Job, when you're saying you're good, you're saying God's bad because he's allowing these things to happen. So this is how he's arguing his point. Now, the other friends are going to argue the same point, but without reference to spooks and things like that.
Okay, I understand. Thank you, Steve.
Sure. I appreciate your call.
You're welcome.
Bye now. Okay, and Brandon from Omaha, Nebraska is next. By the way, our lines are pretty clear if you want to get through. Sometimes they're not. If you want to call me, the number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Brandon, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. Hey, thank you for your program. It's been a huge blessing to me.
Thank you.
First off, I want to be clear. I'm not, nor do I see myself becoming a Jehovah's Witness or a Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that both false doctrines and false prophets have arisen from within that church. Brigham Young, even Joseph Smith at various times of his life, especially towards the end. Since I do believe, though, that it was a pure and God-ordained formation of his church, but they've really gotten away from the truth in some areas, and that's really sad.
You're talking about the Mormon church?
Yes, even the teachings within the Book of Mormon and the Bible, and you see contradictions in that the original teaching of the Book of Mormon that they've stepped away from in the latter revelation.
So what is your question for me?
Well, my question for you is I've recently read through it, and that said,
through the Book of Mormon.
Bereans and yes, mm-hmm. I recently read through it, mm-hmm. and John 4:2 kept coming to mind, which said, "By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses Jesus Christ has come in the flesh of God." And I was shocked to see inexplicable teachings against polygamy, something that's not even taught against necessarily in the Bible specifically. And I marveled that the LDS Church could have fallen so far away from some of those teachings. The Book of Mormon shreds the false doctrine of Calvinism, unconditional eternal security.
So do all the church fathers. But what is it you're asking me?
Well, I guess my question is, have you read through the Book of Mormon in its entirety yourself? And why do you believe its translator, Joseph Smith, at the time of the writing of translating of the Book of Mormon, was a false prophet at that time?
Well, first of all, Joseph Smith didn't know how to translate, and neither did anyone else in the whole world, from what he called Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics, since there's actually no such language known to Egyptologists. No one knows of such a language. He claims that these gold plates were in Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics. Now, Joseph Smith certainly didn't know how to read even non-Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics. He later purchased a mummy that had a scroll in it, and he said it was the Book of Abraham, and it was written in apparently hieroglyphics as well. And Joseph Smith made a translation of it in the Book of Abraham, and then when real Egyptologists got to look at it, they said this has nothing to do with anything he wrote. He's just making up a story. The document actually was discussing ancient funerary rites in Egypt. It was totally unrelated to what Joseph Smith said it was. The man was a shyster. He's basically a con artist. He was one before he found the plates too. In fact, he never did find plates. There's no reason to believe he did, I don't think. But if he did, and if he translated them, it was not from God. The man was not a man of God. He certainly took on those airs after he started his own religion, as many false prophets do. But he was a con artist. He was a fortune teller and did all kinds of occultic things, he and his dad together, in his earlier life. And there's no reason to believe that he ever repented or, became a godly man. His life is not known to have been characterized by consistent godliness, especially his sexual behavior. And so, I mean, there's no reason to believe him. And when someone says, well, this man's a prophet, I say, okay, tell me why I should think so, because not everybody's a prophet, and certainly not everyone who says he's a prophet is a prophet. The Bible says, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing. Well, a sheep's clothing means that they look an awful lot like a godly person. They look an awful lot like a Christian, like a sheep, not a wolf. And so if Joseph Smith didn't look like a sheep, then he wouldn't be very much, he wouldn't qualify much as a false prophet. It's looking like a sheep.
I know he did acknowledge that he had fallen off the wagon, God removed the gifts that he'd given him of prophecy, the gift of tongues and several gifts that he removed from him.
But Joseph Smith did say, Joseph Smith said that the creation was brought about when the chief of the gods called a council of the gods, and together they concocted a plan to create the world and people it. Now, I realize there's actually some popular teaching that resonates with today in Christian circles, so especially Michael Heiser's teaching about the Council of the Gods or the Divine Council. But frankly, it doesn't, in my opinion, agree with the Bible. The Bible doesn't ever talk about a council of the gods that God conferred
with. Right, and that's not in the Book of Mormon, but
It's Joseph Smith's writings, though. It's in the Pearl of Great Price, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. It might be in the Doctrines and Covenants. Yeah,
that's correct.
But that's from the same man. If you're asking me why I don't trust Joseph Smith, it's because there's nothing about him that I see as trustworthy, and that's usually why you would trust someone, is if someone gives evidence of being trustworthy. I certainly wouldn't trust him just because he wrote a book that has impressed some people. I haven't read the whole Book of Mormon for the very reason that I read some of it, and the part of it that I read was so inferior imitation of King James English. I mean, the guy realized people did not speak King James English in Joseph Smith's day. That was three centuries earlier. No, it didn't. No, that way of speaking was gone centuries before his time. And so he gets these magic glasses where he can translate plates written in Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics, an unknown language to any Egyptologist, and he translates them into King James English. Now, if God's going to translate something for for a 19th century audience, why would he use 17th century English? And the thing is, the reason he did it, he wrote it in King James English, is because there was a general feeling that that's the way God speaks, because the King James Bible was the only Bible anyone had. So to make it sound like Scripture, he wrote it in King James English, but he was terrible at imitating King James English. I mean, he says some really awkward things in trying to sound, ancient, in trying to sound Elizabethan in his English. The man was just a fraud, and it's very hard to read his book. I've read parts of it, but I just can't bring myself to do the rest. It just oozes fakeness through it. And by the way, the Book of Mormon gives a history of the Americas and of the Native Americans as allegedly Jews who came over from Israel, and the dark skin came out as a result of being cursed and so forth. So it's kind of a racist story anyway. But the story tells of great civilizations. The book tells about great civilizations on the North American continent before Columbus's time, and cities covering the earth, and people riding horses and having cows and elephants and things like that, none of which were ever here before Europeans brought such things over. So, I mean, the story is, it's a children's story. And there's very many who believe, and I suspect it to be true, that that he got a hold of a novel written by, I think it was a Presbyterian minister named Solomon Spaulding, called Manuscript Found. It was a fictional novel. And Solomon Spaulding died, but his manuscript seems to have been reappeared as the Book of Mormon, with some modifications by Joseph Smith. And people who knew Solomon Spaulding and to whom he had read his manuscript said when they first heard the Book of Mormon, they said, that's the book that Solomon Spaulding read to us, his own book. So, Joseph Smith might not have even been that creative. He might have just plagiarized the whole thing. Anyway, I've given you my reasons. Well, I've got many people waiting, and I should probably take some of the calls.
Appreciate it.
All right. God bless you, and thanks for joining us today. All right. Okay, let's see what we got time for. We're going to take Victor from Seattle, Washington. Welcome to The Narrow Path, Victor. Uh-oh, I'm sorry. I hit the wrong button. Victor, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me? Okay. So, quick question. Do you know what date is the course of Abijah that Zacharias was serving John the Baptist's father? That was one. And then the little bit more evolved question is, have you ever heard of the teaching of the serpent seed? I don't know if you've... know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. I know of it.
Okay. And then to make it faster, I could just take it off air.
Okay, that's fine. The course of Abijah is one of the 24 courses of priests, which the priesthood was divided into. And Zacharias was of one of those courses. And scholars do know, I think, what time of the year that course had its services, because they divided the services up into 24 parts of the year. And I don't remember, I've heard, I don't care, but see, people want to know that because they usually want to decide what date Jesus was born. But I don't think they could learn necessarily from that. Because for one thing, I think, as I've looked at before, the course of Abijah had two different times during the year, as each course did. And I think they're 6 months apart, so we don't know which one of those two would be. It could be in spring or it could be in fall. We don't have any information in the Bible that would help us decide what month Jesus was born, and that's what most people are trying to discover when they ask that question. The serpent seed doctrine is the false doctrine that Eve had sex with the serpent and that Cain was the child of the serpent and Eve. And it usually teaches that the Jews today are the serpent's seed, that they're descended from Cain. This is an absurd and evil doctrine. And they take it from the fact that Jesus told the Jews, you are children of the devil, you're of your father, the devil. But John said in 1 John 3 that whoever sins is a son of the devil. So it's not a racial thing. It's like I'm a son of God. not by race. God didn't father me in the biological sense of the word. A person who's a child of God is somebody who's related to God by affinity, by spiritual affinity. Likewise, a child of the devil is related to him by spiritual affinity. It's not a physical race. There, the idea that Eve had relations with the serpent is just absolutely contrary to the idea of Jews, you know, who they are. The Jews are descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. At least they originally were. It's true, there's been some mixture in the race that's called Jewish, but at the same time, there's nothing in the Bible that would agree with the idea that they were descended from Satan, biologically. I think that's somebody totally misunderstanding some verses and going into a bizarre set of conclusions from them. And there are some teachers who teach that today, unfortunately. We're taking a break at this point. We'll have another half hour ahead, so we're not nearly done. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. We have a website full of resources. They're all free, but you can donate there if you want at thenarrowpath.com. I'll be right back. Don't go away.
The book of Hebrews tells us, do not forget to do good and to share with others. So let's all do good and share The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg with family and friends. When the show is over today, tell one and all to go to thenarrowpath.com where they can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. And be sure to tell them to tune into the show right here on the radio. Share listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share and do good.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. Do you have questions about the Bible, about Christianity, about the Christian faith or teachings? Feel free to call. We'll talk about them. Do you see things entirely differently, or even a little bit differently than the host, and you'd like to balance comment? You can call me about that, too. I do want to announce that this Saturday, for those of you in Southern California, I have a meeting in Temecula open to the public. It's a question and answer gathering. In Temecula, we only do this about once every 2 months. So if you miss this one, it's going to be a while before you get another chance. So you can look at our website about this, and you'll find the time and place. It's at the Love of Christ Fellowship, but that's in a very hard spot to find unless you get the address and the map from our website, thenarrowpath.com. thenarrowpath.com under announcements, and we'll see some of you there Saturday. Right now, we're going to go to the phones. Did I give the number? The number is 844-484-5737. And our next caller is Steve from Santa Cruz, California. Hi, Steve. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, it's good to hear from you, too. And by the way, I listen to the show all the time. But it's taken me weeks to try to call in on this one. I'm concerned just about Bethel up in Reading.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to distinguish between, you know, what is slander of church or church leaders and what is a true warning. And so the thing that has popped up in terms of bothering me is this thing called the kenosis theology, which is Jesus emptied himself of his deity, and I'm not sure if that's what Bill Johnson actually teaches. I haven't read any of his stuff. This is just like third-hand report, and so that's my question.
Okay.
What is your read on this?
Okay, first of all, as far as, criticizing ministers, if you know precisely what they say, and you're sure they have said it, and it's bad or dangerous stuff, then I think you have every reason to pass that along to people who are wishing to follow that teacher so as to warn them. I don't think that's slander at all. I mean, slander would be if you say something that's not true about them. So it's very important when you criticize a minister or a teacher that you make sure that you're right about what you're saying, that he is saying something wrong. Now, I believe Bill Johnson has said a number of things wrong, and I have concerns about the Bethel movement also. But I would clarify something about the kenosis theory. The kenosis theory did not originate with them. It's a long-standing theological position, which in its proper form I actually think is true. But if they're saying that Jesus emptied himself of his deity, that would mean he wasn't God when he came to earth. And that's not the kenosis theory. The word kenosis means empty. And it's taken from the verse in Philippians chapter 2 that says, though he existed in the form of God, he emptied himself and took on himself the form of a servant. He didn't empty himself of being God. He was God. But he laid aside or emptied himself of some of his privileges as God. For example, God is omniscient. Well, Jesus wasn't, as he himself said. He said, I don't know this, only my Father knows that, you know. Jesus was not omnipresent. He was in one place at a time. God is omnipresent. Jesus was not immortal. He was able to die. God is immortal. So we see that there are privileges of godhood that Jesus laid aside in order to become one who lives under our handicaps. But he didn't cease to be God. He didn't give up being God. He simply was, I would say, God trimmed down to our size in order to live as one of us, but still not an ordinary man by any means, but a man who was what God is when he takes on a human form. What the limits of his powers were or you know, whatever, we don't really have any particular information. But Jesus himself said that he cast out demons by the Spirit of God. It says in Acts chapter 1 that Jesus gave commandments to his disciples through the Spirit of God. You know, Jesus said, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to preach the gospel, to open the eyes and so forth, all the things that he was doing. He listed quite a few things. So Jesus himself indicated that he was operating through the Holy Spirit. Now, I can see how this doctrine can be twisted. I have not heard Bill Johnson teach on it, but I could see how someone could say Jesus, though he had been God, he stopped being God. He became a man instead of being God. And then, of course, he was just like us. Well, he wasn't just like us. Certainly the disciples didn't believe Jesus was just like them. But he did lay aside some of his divine privileges. Certainly, I mean, we can't deny that when we see that, God, for example, never becomes weary. The Bible says he doesn't become weary or sleeps, but Jesus became exhausted sometimes, fell asleep, and was hard to wake up even in a storm. God can't be tempted with evil, but Jesus was tempted. So there are things that God and Jesus possessed before he became a man among us. And becoming a man took on handicaps that we have. He didn't stop being God, but he was God taking on our handicaps on himself. And
okay,
that's the way I would understand it.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm going to do further investigation. One final question. There's a lot on the YouTube about do away with Hillsong music in your church.
Oh yeah.
Does that sound overreactive or what?
I think it could be. I don't sing many of the modern worship songs. I've heard Hillsong songs that are quite beautiful, and I've heard modern songs that are not Hillsong but are quite beautiful also. But that a song is beautiful isn't enough. I mean, to me, beautiful music will move you emotionally. But I don't, and there's nothing wrong with getting emotional in your worship, but you have to have content also. Your worship has to be more than just a buzz or a good vibe. Worship has to be an intelligent expression of appreciation for God in terms that are true and that are, genuinely you're convicted of and that you appreciate about God. Now, some people probably sing those songs and get more out of them than I do. I like older songs for myself, but back from the days when you went through my school back in Santa Cruz in the 70s, that era I like better. But that's me. I'm an old guy. The main thing I'm saying is that I don't know that it's wrong to sing songs that come out of there if the songs are okay. I would decide on the value of a song by its contents more than by its author.
Yes.
And the doctrines of its author. It depends on what doctrines are being taught in the song. I certainly I wouldn't use a Hillsong song if its theology was bad, but I wouldn't refuse to sing it if I thought it was very worshipful and true. That'd be my position. I take the songs case by case.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Thank you.
Okay. God bless you, Steve. Good talking to you.
Okie doke. Bye.
Bye now. An old student of mine from a school I ran in Santa Cruz back in 1978. That's when I met Steve. Okay, let's talk to Richard from Seal Beach, California. Richard, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Steve, after Peter had the vision of the unclean foods, what exactly did he do after that? Do we know, did he ever really make it into Rome? Because I've heard that the bones they found in his casket weren't really his. And I just wondered what your opinion on that was, and I'll listen to you on the radio.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'm not really sure what the vision of the unclean foods, how that ties in with the question, but did Peter end up in Rome? There certainly is, I would say, unanimous church tradition to that effect. Now, church tradition is from church fathers, and they're not necessarily inspired like biblical writers. If the Bible said he went to Rome, we'd have confidence that that it's absolutely true. But I have confidence that he did, because the church fathers, many of them lived very near the time of the apostles, and they knew people who knew the apostles. And they would have kept track of important things like that, like when the founders of the church, when they died and where and how. I mean, it's like for someone in the early second century to not know the truth about where Peter died would be like someone living now not knowing where John F. Kennedy was shot. You know, I mean, was that in Dallas or is that just a tradition? No, there's still plenty of people alive like myself who were alive when he died, and we would not forget something like that. And I think the early church would not forget those things. And they'd have no reason, in my opinion, to glamorize or to fabricate or to elaborate on things that weren't true. I think that the church was a very honest institution that really wanted to know the truth about everything, and including their own history. I think they wanted to preserve for future generations the true stories of the founding and development of the church. So I think the early church traditions about Peter and other apostles almost certainly are reliable. And to my mind, there's no alternative traditions out there but that Peter went to Rome late in life and was arrested there, and that he was crucified upside down at the command of Nero. That would be the tradition, and I think it's probably a very reliable one. All right. Appreciate your call. Let's talk to Carol from Oakland, California. Hi, Carol. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thank you. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
This is the question about your website. I've been listening to a lot of the lectures and the archive of of your calls and things, and I was listening to something that was about the zodiac and the stars, and I didn't finish the whole lecture, so I, when I turned it off, and now I can't find it. Can you tell me how to find it on your website?
I cannot. I don't know where it is. I don't use my website very much, and I don't go there very often. We have friends who maintain it, but I don't know that changes are made to it very often. But if changes are, I don't know. I usually don't know about them. I really am an ostrich with my head in the sand when it comes to all the technology. All of the technological stuff of this mystery is done by other people, and I don't even try to figure it out.
It was so beautiful, and it was very touching, and I loved it. And then when I went to call it up again the next night, I couldn't find what subject matter it was under. So, my gosh.
Well, it may have come up in my it's possible that it came up in my lectures on Genesis 1. But I don't always bring up that discussion when I teach Genesis 1, but sometimes I have, and it may be that's where you heard it. Also, it's possible that you were listening to, were you listening to Job ever? Because in Job, God asks Job, can you bring out the signs of the Maseroth, which is the Hebrew word for the zodiac? And sometimes when I'm talking about that passage, I'll bring it up.
This was in great detail because you went over each star in each constellation and how
it. Was it a topical lecture? Was it a topical lecture or was it a digression from some passage we were going through?
I think it was a topical lecture.
Could be. I don't know where that is. I honestly don't know where that is. I do remember teaching on that in detail many years ago. And I know, I don't remember if it was on the website or not, but it probably was.
Yeah, I found it there. And it was so moving and such a worship to listen to the stars and how they pointed to Jesus, how they pointed to everything in the Bible. And I'll go subject by subject if I have to.
I wish I had the information for you. And maybe someone will post it on my Facebook page or something like that.
Let's hope. I was hoping that your wife sometimes sends you little messages. And
she does.
She would know where
she does, but I don't think she knows where it is either. No.
Okay. Yeah, I'll keep trying to find it then.
Okay. Thanks, Carol.
Okay.
Bye now. Bye now. All right. Let's talk to Victor from Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Hi, Victor. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. I, too, am somewhat challenged, but trying to get on board with this electronic stuff. I'm listening to you through my hearing aid, so I mean, if I lose you, I hope not.
Okay.
I have a question and your take. A little while ago, you got together with WMUC and had a one-day kind of a conference in Michigan. And I attended.
Along with Bob Duca,
With Bob. And I've never heard anyone so knowledgeable. And your take on the Bible and its studies are different than any that I've ever listened to. So I have a question.
Okay.
Going to Revelation and the verse, not the verse, but the chapter on the two witnesses.
Chapter 11.
I would like to know what your take is on it, on the two witnesses, who they may be. I've heard, you know, Moses and Elijah coming back and all these things, but what is your take on that?
Well, my take on the two witnesses is, I don't believe that it's talking about two real people. I believe Revelation is very symbolic, and I believe that the two witnesses represent the church. Now, I can't go into my whole scheme of understanding Revelation at this point. I've got too many people waiting and too few minutes left. I will say this, though. If you go to our website, which was just mentioned a moment ago, thenarrowpath.com, and go to the verse-by-verse teachings, you've got my verse-by-verse teachings through all the books of the Bible, including Revelation. Obviously, if you go to Revelation 11, I'll give a very lengthy answer to your question. I really feel like it's hard to give adequate answers to questions about Revelation in this Q&A format because there's so much background. I'm not a futurist, for example. I don't believe it's talking about two future individuals. Those who do think that it's referring to Moses and Elijah, or else Elijah and Enoch is another theory. There's not much of an argument for Enoch, but there would be an argument for Moses and Elijah if it is talking about two men, because they do have the same miracles that Moses and Elijah did. They call fire out of heaven, like Elijah did. They stop the rain for 3.5 years, like Elijah did. They can strike the earth with plagues, like Moses did. They can turn water into blood, like Moses did. These are four miracles that are two each for Moses and Elijah. And so if it was literal people, to call it Moses and Elijah would be a very reasonable suggestion. But I think that the way we're supposed to understand Revelation would militate against us seeing them as the literal people. But I can't go into all my reasons why with my lines nearly full and with only a few minutes left.
Okay.
Okay, wonderful. So go to my verse-by-verse teachings on Revelation. Go to chapter 11, and you'll get an earful, okay?
An earful? Thank you so much, Steve.
Take care. Victor. I appreciate your call. God bless you. All right, let's talk to Chris from Spokane, Washington. Chris, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello, Dave.
Steve.
Enjoy your show. Steve, I'm sorry.
Sure.
Kidding me. So full disclosure, I am not myself a believer. but okay. I very much enjoy learning about theology. And a very interesting argument I've heard pop up over the last couple of years has kind of annoyed me and then just kind of puzzled me. And that is the tendency of a lot of pastors in particular, and lay Christians as well, to say that Christianity is not a religion,
okay.
Which defies every definition I've heard of for religion. Can you explain what the argument is?
Sure.
Better, or are you familiar with this? Or
of course,
maybe
yeah,
what
I will.
What the history of that is?
Well, first of all, the only reason to refer to Christianity as a religion is that it now has become one of the great world religions, divided into thousands of denominations, including the Roman Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox and hundreds, thousands of Protestant denominations. Each of them has their own worship, you know, style and theology and so forth. Now, it depends on how you define a religion. I would not define Christianity as a religion because Jesus didn't come and start a new religion. He actually was a Jew. Now, he did change the terms of a relationship with God, but Jesus never indicated that a relationship with God was based on religion. The Jews followed a religious order, offering animal sacrifices and things like that in order to have a relationship with God. Jesus pretty much abolished all of that, and he didn't set any new religious rituals in their place. In other words, he didn't really start a religion. He started, I think, as he would put it, a family and a kingdom. He basically was calling people to recognize that they are God's children, and that he was establishing a kingdom, and God was allowing people to come into the kingdom. Now, if we call a religion any belief system in which there's a God, then Christianity would have to be called a religion. But you don't have to be part of any particular religion to believe what Jesus said. You basically have to be a believer in Jesus himself. And this is why it is also different than other things that are called religions, that religions are belief systems that are established by some founder who is now dead, and people become part of that religion by simply signing on to the beliefs and rituals of that teacher's teachings. Whereas Christianity is following a teacher who's alive. He died, but he rose again, and he's alive. So it's a relationship with him.
Well, so part of my ulterior motive for asking this question is that I am a believer in strength for all acquaintances and friends, and I've noticed the tendency of Christian acquaintances of mine to weaken in their Christianity when they start to go down this path, a kind of opening to Unitarianism, and a once you stray from Christianity, it isn't about the law, which I admire about it over Judaism and Islam, for example, which are religions of the law. Christianity is much more spiritual, but there seems to be a danger of it morphing into anything and nothing if even non-Christians can follow the teachings of Jesus.
Well, when you say non-Christians, I would use the word Christian the way the Bible used it, not the way that it's used today. The Bible uses the word Christian three times, and only one time does it define it. And it says in Acts 11:26, the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. So according to the Bible's definition, a Christian is a term that should be only used for people who are disciples. And disciples are people who've signed on to following Jesus as their king and their Lord in everything in their lives. And he never said anything about, you know, weekly meetings or singing songs or listening to sermons or doing those things that religions do. Now, he wasn't against people singing songs and listening to sermons. He just didn't establish anything like that. He set up a situation where he was the king and his disciples were subject to him and followed him. Now, people who buy into that are not at all weak. And in fact, they're usually much more committed than the average churchgoer is. Unfortunately, when Christianity kind of morphed into a religion based on rituals and ceremonies and things and attending religious meetings and so forth, that's when it became weak, because people who didn't have any real belief in Jesus or any commitment to him began to regard themselves to be Christians because they went to these religious meetings called Christian meetings in a building that was called a Christian church. But that was already a removal from the original position that Jesus and the apostles held to what Certainly. Christianity is. So they didn't see it as a one of the world religions.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but thank you for that. I didn't know Christianity was actually defined in the Bible, so that helps. And to clarify, the weakness I'm referring to is the idea that Jesus was essentially a good moral teacher, which allows...
When Christians go that route, they really are moving away from being really Christians at all. You're right. I agree with you on that. Yeah,
But
I've held the position I'm saying for 50 years now, and I haven't weakened at all in my devotion to Christ or to following the Bible or believing what the Bible says. So I have all the beliefs and practices in my life that Christians that are described in the Bible as being Christian, but I just am not a very religious person, and I don't know if I ever want to be. Okay. Appreciate your call, Chris.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I hope you call again sometime. We can talk longer when we have more time.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks for the great show.
All right. Thank you. Bye now. Let's try to get Ronald from Vancouver, Washington in here. Not much time left. Hi, Ronald.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a quick question about John 14, 2.
Yeah.
Jesus talking about Pharaoh's house. I have many mansions, and I'm going to prepare the place for you. So it's really confusing. I hear different explanations, but it's still not clear completely what Jesus is talking about. What are those mansions, and what he's actually preparing? Thank you for your answer. I'll take on the radio. Thank you.
Okay, and thank you for your call. I will say this. I'll try to answer you, but I only have a couple minutes left, and I really would like to take much longer to answer this question. You can go to my website, verse-by-verse teachings, and go to the Gospel of John and go to the lecture on John 14, and I go into this much more than I will here, so I'll just give you that as a reference. When Jesus said, "In my Father's house are many mansions," first of all, the word mansions, which you're asking about, is not a good translation of the Greek word mone. It's the word mone that is used. And one of the things that's interesting about this word is it only occurs one other time in the Bible, and that's in the same chapter. So whatever you say, what are these mansions? Well, what are the mones? Well, Jesus answers that later in the same chapter when he says in verse 23, it says, Jesus answered and said to him, "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come and make our mone with him." Mone in the Greek means a dwelling place. It doesn't mean a mansion. It means a place where someone dwells. In fact, most modern translations translate as rooms. "In my Father's house are many rooms." Now, rooms are places where people dwell, or in this case, where God dwells, because it's God's house. God dwells in his house, and he dwells in many rooms. Jesus said, if you obey me and love me, then you can become one of these rooms. My Father and I will love you and will come and make our room with you. So the many rooms are Christians. Then what is the house? Well, heaven is never referred to as God's house in the Bible, but the temple is. But in the New Testament, the church, the body of Christ, the community of Christians, that's the holy temple. That's the temple of God. And it's made of living stones. So his Father's house is where God dwells. And God dwells in his people, in the church. And there are many rooms in that house. And each of us who believes in Christ and follows him is one of those rooms. That's what he's saying. Now, there's more that needs to be said. You can go to John. Or there was a call on this July 1st of last year, the sixth call. If you want to go to our archives at the website, the Narrow Path Archives, the sixth call on July 1st of last year. I went into this, and I'm not going to give another one. Too little time. We're done in about 10 seconds. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener-supported. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.